Welcome to It Shipped That Way, where we talk to product leaders about the lessons they've learned helping build great products and teams. I'm Alan Pike, and today's interview is with Charity Majors. Charity is a writer, speaker, the CTO of observability platform Honeycomb.io, and was previously in engineering leadership for Facebook, Parse, and Second Life. Welcome, Charity.
Thank you for having me.
I am so excited to get into topics, engineering management, leadership, culture. There's so many things we could talk about. But first, I want to give you a chance to give a high level, especially on Honeycomb. You know, I'm sure some folks in the audience are familiar with it. Some people aren't. It would be great to get like a bit of calibration. Where are you at in the journey? And how big is the team? That kind of high level to kind of orient us.
Totally. You know, we started Honeycomb January 1st of 2016. I am more shocked than anyone that we are still alive. You know, I was never one of those kids who's like, I'm going to start a company. Because I really have always like low-key hated those people. It's like, oh, you're too good to work for anyone else. Like, fuck you. Sorry, I don't know what the
That's okay. We can explicit tag. Okay. No problem.
Great. I should come with those just like slapped to my forehead, really. We started in 2016 and we had so many near-death experiences. I would say that, you know, so like we were the first one to originate observability. Everyone calls their shit observability now, but like back when we started, like I was searching for a way to talk about what we were trying to build, because I knew it was like generationally different from the monitoring and the metrics and the logs that I had grown up with. And, you know, we stumbled across control theory and the definition of control theory, the definition of observability and control theory is how well can you understand what's happening inside your system just by looking at it from the outside, you know? And I was like, oh shit, that's what we're trying to do. And there are so many technical prerequisites that like proceed from that. Like you can't be locked into, you know, predefining a schema or like knowing in advance what questions you're going to ask, or indexing, or like high cardinality, high dimensionality, like explorability, like traceability, like all these things are just table stakes. It took us years to figure all this stuff out. But like we first got product market fit, I think in 2019, 2020. But like for the first 5 years of the company, we were like no more than, we were like 15 to 30 people. And then last year, we 2 years ago, we doubled in size. And then last year, we doubled in size again. I think doubling in size is about as fast as you can responsibly grow without losing your culture and your systems and everything. So now we're at 170 people. And we kind of took a pause from really growing over the last year. And we're gearing up for another big spread of growth next year. So, you know, we're in the several tens of millions of dollars in ARR. I will say it's both a good problem to have that everybody's now, we do observability too, and it's a bad problem because it no longer has any meaning. But, you know, and there's a lot of people out there who are still like leveling up and doing dashboards and instrumentation, and they get a lot of value out of those. But the value you can get out of going, I think, to what I think of observability is really next level, which is hard to talk about when everyone's using the same words and terms and use cases, but the engineers who have tried it, like you can't pry it out of their cold, dead hands. One of our best sources of leads is engineers who change companies. And they're like, I can't go back to developing without this. It becomes so core to how I function, which is exactly the experience that drove me and Christine to build it. So it's been hard. The first few years were just brutal. Like I lost my marriage, I stopped sleeping and everything. But I feel like it's leveled out and it's starting to get fun 8 years in.
That's all the trick. You gotta grind for 8 years and turn everything upside down and then double a bunch of times and then it gets fun.
And then it starts to get fun.
Yeah. You're also at an interesting point here. With that, I'm already diverging from the topics I want. I want to talk about engineering leadership. And then I'm like, oh, this is an interesting story that I want to engage with. The fact that you're at this 150-person size class is kind of, there's a famous Dunbar's number where you get onto the other side of that and then suddenly things change around all these topics around how do you do leadership and communication and think about your team and org and stuff like that. So that's like really interesting, useful context because you have people at different organizations that think very differently about this stuff sometimes because they're in totally different worlds. So
absolutely. And the big thing for me has been making the implicit explicit, you know, at the last year. And like to a certain extent, I think that being a distributed company has actually made this transition easier than it might otherwise be, because one of the ways to succeed at doing a distributed company is making the implicit explicit, writing things down, having processes. You know, when you're all sitting together in a room, you could go a long way on just like looking each other in the eye, just like knowing how each other works. And like, you know, but like you can't function that way when people aren't sitting together.
Were you always a distributed company, or was that a like 2020 shift?
Yes and no. In the early days, you know, for the first 2 or 3 years, it was really just four of us. And so we were in the same room, and it really helped accelerate our growth at that stage. We always knew that we wanted to be a distributed company though. And as soon as we got past the like 30, 40, 50 people mark, we started seriously investing in that, because in one way it's an equity thing. Like there's so many great people who can't live in San Francisco, can't afford to, you know, buy a house here or whatever. And another way it's like, I am very neurodivergent, and the things that make companies work well, distributed companies, also make them work well for me. So there was a bit of a selfish angle in there for that,
like
too.
Like saying things explicitly instead of just assuming we all just know here's
exactly
a subtle thing that everyone follows.
Exactly. So like we hired our first remote exec actually a month before the pandemic. So that was nicely timed. But even before that, we had been doing something I think everyone should do, which is once a quarter, we'd have weekly drills where everyone had to work from home, from the CEO on down. Everyone had to work from home. Like it's enough time. You have to actually figure out how to do work together and move. You figure out all the channels that you were kind of relying on that didn't exist, and it forces you to move your communication online, which was really helpful.
Cool. I like that. Before 2020, we all did a one day a week, which is maybe doesn't actually have as thorough of a, you know, you could get maybe your weekly meeting still happened, right? But it gave us a little bit of that. You write about engineering leadership at the domain charity.wtf, which is the best domain of all time.
Thank you, I agree.
It's just like, it's like, what are we getting here? And it just like sets the tone, like, which is, you know, I mean, I guess it could be more WTF than it is, but it sets the tone of it's going to be kind of fun and engaging, which it is. And you talk about a lot of the same topics that we do on this show about leadership and building teams and cultures and stuff like that. And so I just wanted to pull in some topics today that you've written about over the last while, and then just kind of talk through them and some of the mental models and systems that you've had on your mind and you've been building and growing this business. And I feel like a good place to start is at the beginning of the management journey. Especially when you're growing a company, you may end up with people who are relatively new to management. Either you're promoting people, or maybe you're bringing in people who are relatively earlier in their career, or maybe they've been managing for a while, but maybe not at the level that they could be. And so what do you think of the sort of typical rookie mistakes or just beginner mistakes or growth opportunities that you see when people are sort of, they have opportunities for growth in terms of management?
You know, this links to something I've been thinking about a lot lately, which is just like how much our standards for managers, engineering managers, have risen over the past several years. You know, it used to be like you're getting promoted to everyone's mom is going to congratulate you when you become a manager, right? Because it's like, oh, congratulations, it's a promotion. You're becoming more important now, right? And I think for a long time, it was kind of structured that way at a lot of companies where managers made decisions. And if you wanted to have a say in something, you had to be a manager. That's why I became a manager, because I wanted to have a seat at the table, right? But I feel like, you know, we now like expect managers to create a lot of psychological safety, to like be kind of do a lot of emotional labor, to do a lot of, you know, at the same time as it's become a less authoritarian role, which is good for everyone. But it's also like, you know, when I wrote that piece, The Engineer Manager Pendulum, back in 2017, I felt like all of the incentives were for people to go into management. It was the default for ambitious people, you know? And now I feel like the pendulum, to coin a phrase, has swung the other way. And it's like, so many amazing managers left management, especially during the pandemic, because it's like,
oh, yeah,
the job got so much harder. And it doesn't have the like same sheen of like promotion, career growth as it once did. And people are like, oh, wait, I mean, I can get paid the same, do engineering work, do all this labor as a staff plus person, and then go home feeling great at the end of the day. Why don't I do that? So I think it's a really interesting kind of, it's a different world than it was a few years. But you were asking about rookie mistakes. And so the biggest one that I think I experienced and I see in my neck of the woods is it's the flavor of, you know, okay, I'm an engineer. I have a lot of opinions. I don't feel like I've ever had a good manager. So I have a lot of opinions about what not to do. So I'm going into management and I am not going to do any of those things. I am not going to make any of those mistakes, right? I am going to be a coach. I'm going to be empathetic. I'm going to encourage people to take time off. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to do all these things. And
that all sounds great, Charity.
It's great. And you do all those things. But what you're not seeing is like, that's not all there is to management. Not making those mistakes is not all there is. There's also like, learning about the business, really like, you know, managing for outcomes. There's the aspects of like, you know, it's not just the things that you don't do. It's the things that you need to do, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Well, you wrote a piece recently where you were talking about this kind of idea of helicopter management, which some people will use that term to refer to micromanagement, which is its own problem, which we could potentially talk about if you want to talk about micromanagement. But then there's also this idea, which, to, you know, getting to what you're saying, where some people either, whether because they're a new manager or because the environment they come from or because of responding to trauma or because of what they've been reading and the focusing on about what it in their mind it means to be a good manager, they allocate 100 or 110% of their management capacity to retaining their team and supporting people and making sure everyone has work they enjoy.
Oh, that is what I said. I'm like trying to remember what it was that I wrote. I'm like, there was something good. No, you're right. It was that. It's like that.
All those good things that we want to do as managers, but
it's not the whole job. There's a lot that goes into being a good manager that you don't actually see from the perspective of being an engineer and being one of those direct reports, right? As being a good manager, it's not just interfacing with your team. It's also like managing up, making sure that the people, I kind of hate the hierarchical terms, but whatever, making sure, representing your team to upper management so that they're aware of the critical things that are going on, so that they're getting really important signals from your team members, so that they're getting the right signals, so that they can make good decisions based on the limited amount of information that they have. It's about building the infrastructure of your organization, you know, spending time like, you know, crafting the intern programs or working on the job ladders with other managers or doing interview training. Like there's all this stuff that goes into building the infrastructure of the company that doesn't have a lot to do with actually, you know, interfacing with your team. And I think that there's a lot of interesting stuff there. I also feel that like there's often a bit of when managers stop managing, they're often told, you know, you can't write any more code, right? You have to stop writing code, which is, and I understand why people are giving them that advice because, you know, we all have a happy place where we feel strong and confident and comfortable. And we want to retreat to that place when we feel scared. And when you're a baby manager, you have to force yourself to get out of that comfort zone and not just like go back to where you last felt good. It's actually great for your team if you continue to contribute to things that are not in the critical path, right? Picking up a bug, feeling some of their pain, not being in the on-call rotation, but being like the first backup. Like, you want to go to a movie on Saturday? Give me a call. If you had a rough night last night, I'll take it tomorrow night. You know, kind of being in the mix.
And keep your ability to engage with the technical things that your team is responsible for and being able to be in those conversations
exactly.
is super powerful. And that's often what people are worried about when they say, oh, I don't want to stop writing code because they're afraid of not being able to engage in those conversations anymore, or that they may end up finding themselves in a couple of years on the other side of that pendulum of being like, okay, it seemed like I might want to be an engineering manager and now I regret, I would like to undo.
Yeah.
And now
yeah.
I don't know what all these new frameworks, you know, the JavaScript completely changes every 2 years. And so yeah, I can't write front-end code anymore or whatever. So there's like a reasonable desire there. And so what you're saying is that if we're building our diet right as a manager in terms of how we're spending and allocating our time and attention, we can make space for some of those individual contributor-like activities, honing our skills, self-improvement, all that kind of stuff, as long as we don't put 110% of our time into the things that we maybe imagined were the job before we became a manager.
It's like, it's very important that like, you know, I believe that you can only really be improving and working on your skills as a manager or as an engineer you can't really be improving in both domains at once, I think, because being an engineer requires intense focus and being a manager requires intense interruptibility. And they're kind of not compatible.
This is a famous like manager schedule, maker schedule. And to some degree, people will say the manager's job is partially to let the people who report to them then focus on stuff.
Yeah. So like, I think you can maintain your skills in one and grow in another, but I don't think you can grow both skill sets at once. Not really.
Yeah, that makes sense. One of the things you were writing about I found interesting in this topic of this kind of helicopter management and, you know, over-indexing on managing down, so to speak, if we need to use the hierarchical terms, probably a better term we could use for that. But focusing on supporting the team or your idea of what supporting a team looks like, a story that you told in that I found interesting was about somebody who you had gone to great lengths to get their performance to, you didn't use this terminology, but what I would call like getting the performance up to this like 3 out of 4 star level.
Yeah.
And retain them on the team. And they took a huge percentage, you know, certainly more out of proportion with other people on the team, but maybe the majority or maybe 90% of your time and attention in terms of supporting people was going to this one person. And for years you supported them enough that they could get that 3 out of 4 star performance. And then later you reflect on that and kind of smack on your forehead and you're like, was that actually fair to the rest of the team? Was it actually helpful for the company? Unclear.
And there are different flavors of this situation. Like the one flavor is where it's an underperformer, you know, and you're kind of like propping them up. This one's actually a little more interesting than that. Like they were actually a very high performer, but they took a lot of corralling. They took a lot and they took a lot of emotional like support and like, you know, mediating relationships between them and the rest of their team. They're a little bit of a prima donna, you know? And so, and to me, it was like, well, they bring so much, right? When they're on, like they bring so much to the team. And I felt really proud of myself for keeping them there, keeping them productive. And it's just like you said, you know, and I was proud of it. Like I would have said, this is one of my top achievements as a manager straight up until after I'd been a CEO for a couple of years. And I started to look back on that and go, you know, what else could I have done with that time and energy? Who else could I have given it to? What else could I have done for myself and my career? What could I have done for the team? And honestly, was it even the best thing for them in the long run? I don't think it was, because they didn't learn the lessons that they needed to about how not to be so hard on their team and their leaders, which means that they got fired from the next job they had in a way that I think was kind of brutal, right? And I think that like, the longer those things go on in your career, the harder they are to unlearn, right? And I feel like I ultimately don't think I did anyone a favor by keeping that situation going as long as I did. I've also seen this be in situations where there's a contributor who is just so fun to have around. They're just so great. And you really love them as a person. And when they're really focusing, they can deliver that 3 out of 4. But they aren't always that into their job, and they, you know, and it takes, you know, constant like corralling and stuff. And, you know, you have serious come to Jesus conversations with them once or twice a year, but they always manage to get it together enough to like, you know, get it. But it's only when you look back on that after a couple of years and you're just like, it's going to be like this forever, isn't it? It's never actually going to get any better. And like that cycle, you can see the impact on the team and on you, but it's also, I would argue, it's not that great for them. It's not, there are other jobs, you know, I have a couple people in mind, I don't want to get too specific, but like they went on to find jobs that made them much happier. Not every job has the same intensity, the same quirks, the same, you know, other team members, the same, you know, it's not even a, are you good or are you bad? Are you better? Or are you worse? Sometimes it's just like not a great personality fit or something. And if that person is on thin ice once every year, a couple times a year, that's terrible for them. That's so stressful. They would probably be happier somewhere else.
Yeah, I really struggle with that. That you, especially as a manager, you think in terms of the roles that you have on your team. And you think of those as the roles that you're responsible for. And so when you see somebody not necessarily either performing very well or you're struggling to retain someone in that role, you tend to think of it as a failure of you or them. Like, you know, you learn over time that that's not the only causes, but that's the default where place our mind goes. And something that I used to struggle with a lot is if somebody was in really a poor role fit or sometimes a poor organization fit, right? Maybe they would be great at Google with all of the supports they have. And then in our 5-person startup, it's like a horrible fit or the other way around, right? But to kind of be able to suss out the difference in between me not supporting someone enough, which were my instinct as this manager who was previously IC that wasn't supported enough. I want to support everyone maximally, and then start to kind of be able to analyze the situation and look at this person and think, well, they're actually, I'm able to hear what you're saying. And instead of hearing, oh no, I need to support this person to an amount that they are enjoying this job that's a poor fit for them. Instead, I think maybe, like, you don't want to ultimatum people, but to kind of work with them to kind of think, okay, well, what kind of things would you enjoy? What kind of things would engage you? And not necessarily take that to mean like, oh, therefore I need to try to contort this job that you currently hold to be something that it's not.
You know, I'm so glad you said that. I wish we didn't live in a world where healthcare was tied to employment, because that complicates this sometimes. But like in my ideal world, you would be able to forge the kind of trust and relationship with your reports to where them leaving is almost always kind of a mutual thing, where you just kind of like, you both come to the realization that this isn't great. So let's just talk about how can we support each other through this transition? You know, maybe stick around for a month or two, you know, if you need the salary, and I know you can't take the break, but like, we need you to be looking or something. But like, they know when they're not doing well, and you know, and there comes a point where you're just kind of wearing them down in their spirit, that when you try to keep them here and happy, you know, I feel like, yeah, so Honeycomb, we call it graduation when someone leaves. We give people the option of like, we'll throw you a little party, we'll come, we'll tell the favorite stories of when you were here. And several, you know, there have been several of our really senior people who have been here for a long time who we just kind of ultimately either we come to put, like, we don't want to put them on a PIP. Like, it's just it's a terrible way to end a relationship like this. And it's humiliating and everything. But we kind of have to just be like, look, you're not having fun here anymore, are you? And it shows, and it's hard. It's hard on you. It's hard on everyone. In almost every case, if you try to approach them as equals and you just like acknowledge what's in front of you, and you know, my perhaps Pollyanna-ish wish is that we should be able to have those conversations. You know, one of our company values is that we hire adults, and I feel like treating people like adults is, to me, that means I want to hear hard truths. You know, you can't trust someone's no until you've heard their no, right? If someone's willing to tell you hard things, then you know that you can trust what they're saying when they tell you not hard things. And to me, that I would want anyone who reports to me to feel like they can come to me and just be like, I don't know if this is working anymore, without any fear of like reprisal or punishment. And like, I also feel like often like managers feel like they're supposed to try and beat people into staying or convince them or like strong arm them into staying. And it's like, that's not good. That doesn't really work. If they don't want to be here, they shouldn't. We should only have this employee-employer relationship as long as this is genuinely the best thing for you at this time in your career. Eventually it won't be. And that's fine.
Yeah. I think there's an interesting mindset where we know as managers that retaining great people is a huge benefit to the company. And certainly at some companies, a certain scale, you'll get measured in that in a very just like, okay, here's a percentage or a number. And then you want to try to achieve that number. You can get a little bit thoughtless about it. But there's a reason why the diving save of somebody who's like not happy anymore and they're out the door. And it, especially if it's a role fit or company fit thing, or they've just at a different point in their career now, as opposed to they've been mismanaged in some way and they were wronged in a way that can easily be righted. But like that diving save is pretty looked down upon by, I think, a lot of thoughtful managers of like, at that point, it's like, are you really helping them? Are you really helping the business? If you're like, oh, we're going to try to emergency find some extra compensation for you, or we're going to make you some promise to like, it's already kind of dissolving. They're already not happy. Where the real value I think of, and I imagine you would agree from what you're saying, in building, because we all know we want a high retention culture, we want to keep good people, is doing that like all the way through and not like at the end when things have already gone wrong.
Yeah, because then you just incentivize everybody to bring a crisis. It's like the only way they can get your attention is by quitting or bringing a crisis or something. Absolutely. And it's not that I don't think that there's ever diving saves that can or should be performed. I've seen a couple that, yeah, that was the right thing to do. Should it, you know, it was correcting something that, you know, probably should, and it went on to be very successful, but you can't create a track record or like a culture of doing that. Absolutely agree. When I worked at Linden Lab and made Second Life, I remember this was very early in my career. I remember there was a point after being there for a couple of years where we were just like, wow, I can't remember anyone ever voluntarily leaving this company. And we were so proud of that, that this was a company that nobody wanted to leave. People loved working there. And now I look back and I'm like, it was not a great sign. It wasn't. And we did not know how to have managers. We didn't have any sort of like performance management. There were some amazing people there. And there were some people who just coasted and did nothing or were actively harmful. And there was nobody kind of minding the store and like tending to the weed. It was not really nice to call people weeds, but like there were problem patches and nobody dealt with them.
No, but yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think that it is very easy to get into this mindset of 100% retention is the goal. When realistically, even putting aside this thing of people are going to grow up and their interest in what engages them is going to change over time. And the company is going to probably hopefully change over time in technology. I hope your company is changing. And then you also occasionally are going to have some people that have some toxic elements. Like hopefully your hiring filter is keeping out the people who are extreme max toxicity, or you immediately notice as soon as they start. But sometimes people will really be on the edge and they'll have some subtle things that are corrosive to either just in general, in your view of what a healthy company culture is, or the type of team or the type of thing that you're building. And it's harmful to other people on your team. And if you keep that mindset of like, oh, well, let's retain everyone, you're sort of like almost necessarily, like, again, to be clear, I'm very much on pro team. Let's have long tenures. Let's hire people for the long term. Let's do long term decisions. But if it's zero and your aim is zero, you're going to tend to end up with situations that are bad, lasting way longer than they should. Bad, like you say, bad for the person, bad for the rest of the team. And I think that's one of those manager lessons.
I actually think the most harmful thing any manager can do is not deal with problem people.
But we have a whole bunch of people who have instinctual conflict avoidance that would really rather not deal with it. So
yeah, sure.
maybe we'll just support them a little bit more. But no, I think it's a really, it's an interesting thing, and I think a valuable thing to push ourselves on. I appreciate that kind of like that framing for it. Do you have any sort of mental model or kind of useful system or framework that you use for gauging when you have somebody on your team, or you're supporting a manager who's struggling with someone on their team, to kind of gauge the difference in between, okay, this is somebody that's needing a lot of support, but we want to support our team. We support people. Like, that's part of how you retain good people. That's part of how you build psychologically safety. It's not like someone has a hard time or makes a mistake and then you're like, okay, bye. Like, that's how you create all the worst psychological things on your team, right? So you want people who support their teams. How do you kind of gauge, though, when it's like too much? Maybe that's just like a fundamentally hard question that has no answer, but like, is there?
It's such a hard question. And I look back and I'm like, yeah, we always wait a little too long to deal with some of these things. But then on the other hand, you're never going to get it perfect. And I think I'd rather us wait too long than not long enough, all things considered. So like, I have a couple of heuristics. One of them is just like in the first 90 days of someone's, you know, tenure, like managers are so much in support, enable mode. And I think it's really important that you remind them to periodically stop and check themselves and ask themselves a question like, honestly, if I could get a redo on hiring this role, would I do that? Or would I want to stick with this person and invest in them? Right? It's not like you want to have that front of mind all the time. But if you're 9 days in, you're like, wish I could like throw this fish out and try another one. That is not a good sign, because our default is to want to, you know, keep and invest in the people we have. Another one is just like remembering to ask ourselves, do we really see this getting better at any point? Like, honestly, like, because there's a lot of times when you're so in it and you're so busy supporting and everything that you don't really stop and go, can I envision this ever getting better? And when you do, you're just like, or you're like, yeah, I can. And this is what it would look like, right? I also think that, and this one's a little tricky, because you don't want to fall into the whole like productive asshole thing where it's like, well, but they're so productive that, you know, yes, we don't care if they're dicks. But there's also like, oh, what was the Google thing? That there's some Google, forget the terms, but it's like high performers are either, was it prima donna and workhorses or something? But it's like, so some are just like no drama, you know, and then some of them, they're a handful, but they're worth it. And I put myself in the handful but worth it category, you know, but like the more of a handful someone is, the more they do have to be worth it, you know?
Yeah. I think that there's a useful, I've seen a few frameworks of this and like
divas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I struggle a little bit like to come up with good terms sometimes for folks that are a handful. I much prefer the term handful to diva or prima donna. Or like, unfortunately, a lot of the terms for people who require a disproportionate amount of manager attention tend to be gendered, which I don't love. Or like, even if they're not explicitly general, but like obviously prima donna is like very explicitly, right? But some of these terms, like, but what I think there's a useful mental model that I saw recently with similar model of this is this idea of mapping performance and trust. Right. And so that's I found useful. Like sometimes some people just need a little bit more support. And like you say, that's not, it's not inherently like, oh, they're toxic to the team. They're harming one another, other people. They're right. Sometimes people need a little bit of support or maybe a little bit of a handful.
Yeah. Like for example, they make some waves, but often that's because they're like, you know, shaking up some places that are comfortable that probably shouldn't be so comfortable, right? And it's just like that needed to be disrupted.
Yeah, like someone who asks hard questions that you know, everyone else has been too conflict averse to ask, like that's actually really valuable, even if that means that person is going to require more energy or attention. So the I've been recently kind of playing around with my head of this mindset. Instead of thinking about, well, how much manager attention do these people make? It's like, how trusting and trustworthy are these people on the team, right? Like if we know we want to have high trust teams, we want to have teams where there's high psychological safety, who are the people on the team that are that fostering trust, that they're trustworthy, the other people on the team trust them. The more time you spend, the people you trust them, they do what they say what they're going to do. And that is positively affecting team trust. And who are the people that are pulling your attention because they're undermining that trust or maybe just maybe neutral, you know, but like that's something I've been kind of increasingly thinking of as maybe a useful signal in that rather than sorting people into, yeah, this person draws attention to themselves. But like sometimes that's really good to your point.
I don't remember if this is part of the needs versus diva thing or if I dreamed it or whatever, but like my memory is that part of it was like, are they out for themselves or are they out for the company? Like, are they shaking waves or anything because it's about them? Or are they earnestly like just trying to do what's best for the team, for the org, for the company? And sometimes it's just not super elegant, but like that's how sausage does get made, right? And I think that the way you put it is great. The more time you spend with them or working with them, do you trust them more or do you trust them less? I think that those are kind of interesting ways, not entirely alike, but like kind of getting at the same thing. Like are there...
Yeah, they're very related, I think. Like the people that we tend to trust and the people that build trust rapidly are the people who demonstrate, probably not super intentionally, but just like you observe how they think and how they make their decisions, they demonstrate a team-oriented mindset of, well, okay, you know, this is going to help us achieve our common goal and we're going to rally in this direction and I'm going to be plainly, legibly working towards that. And then the people who sometimes undermine trust is the people who will make a reasonable argument, which then in retrospect, you realize actually ended up maybe benefiting them to the detriment of the team or to your own. Like, oh, they're making an argument. It's like, yeah, that seems reasonable. We should make that change. And retrospect, you realize like, wait a minute, now there's a whole bunch of work that's not on your plate anymore. And now you can get that other thing that you wanted, right? Like not that you want to ascribe evil motivations to people, because most of the time people aren't even doing, it's not evil. It's just like, you know, are you motivated by trying to achieve a common goal? Or are you motivated by your pet thing that you care about?
And there's a subtler flavor of that too, which is not even that they're like out for themselves, but just like, do they tend to be right? Over time, do they eventually because those are the people that I learned to listen to, like even if it doesn't sound right to me, I'm like, well, you know, history says I should probably pay attention and that's probably worth, you know, keeping around.
Yeah, that's an interesting point to me, because one of the things that we talk about on our team sometimes, and this comes from like a Brené Brown quote, which is that you want people who value getting it right rather than being right. Like if you reward being right, then you're inherently punishing being wrong, which then creates people not worried about whether or not they say their mind, right? And so we all want to be, we're trying to get it right. And so I really like that mindset. But there's a little thread that I'm still kind of working through how to reason about is that even though we're a team that values getting it right and we don't want to be focusing on, this person was wrong or this person was right, there is, to your point, a sort of a trust that builds up when someone is often right, right? Like, and so I think I just want to, I haven't I'm sort of thinking out loud on a podcast. I want to build up my kind of mental model for how do we maybe talk about as an organization or as leaders about the trust that comes when somebody is right in a way that doesn't maybe enshrine the rightness, but maybe enshrine something more closer to like when they spend social capital, when they make waves, when they are willing to maybe transgress makes it sound more dramatic maybe than it needs to be, but when they're able to like kind of rally attention of like, hey, come on, everybody, we need to do better about this. In retrospect, was that a good investment? Was it worthy of our attention? This may be like a little more specific thing, like were they right? Which is, I know exactly what you mean when you say that.
Yeah. No, that's super interesting. I like what you're saying there.
So building off of that, we have this thread, and this is kind of related to this idea of thinking about the teams that we're on and the organizations they were in as a system, which is very much one of these like, okay, now I'm a more senior manager, or I'm a manager of managers, or I'm a VP or CEO or whatever. You tend to get more and more people as they move up in those levels talking about systems thinking and how do we teach systems thinking and how do we encourage our people to think beyond the micro, exactly what meeting you're in, exactly what the person said, or whatever your idea of why they might have done what they do. And so I saw you writing about this, which I love. I was curious, like, how do you define systems thinking? Because I've recently found myself trying to talk about it more in the context of my job. And I mean, yeah, I'm imperfect yet currently about how I kind of define it and encourage, like, how do we hire and teach systems thinking? What do we even mean by this?
I've been reading a bunch of some systems thinking books that Jessa Tron, her blog is about system stuff is really good. There are some people who are really good abstract thinkers, and I'm not one of them. Like, I need stories. And then after I have stories or experiences, I can kind of fit them into systems, and then I can reason about the systems. But like, I find it really challenging to jump straight to the structure. The systems thinking aspect, I feel like, is like, we're social animals. So we tend to think about, you know, things as being on a very sort of like personal level. But like so much of our behavior, maybe all of it, if you ask some determinists, is like, is not actually defined by, you know, what we think or what we think we think or what we think we feel, but the situations around us, the relationships, the scenarios, the history. And I think of systems thinking as being a way of just trying to shift our attention to the structural things that influence the way we behave or the way that we move through the world, usually without our noticing. And most people are not naturally attuned to this. It is a learnable skill. And I think that any effective manager of managers has learned to do it in a lot, because so much of going higher up the leadership chain is really, I have a tweet thread about how, you know, being a CEO is a long, slow march towards sociopathy, because if you're going to do it effectively, you have to learn to like switch off your little empathy button, like fucking data, turn off little empathy thing and think about people as resources and think about them as you have to like stop thinking them as fully human or you can't function. You know, we had to do layoffs years and years ago. And I remember the only way we made it through was just like, I just had to like think about numbers, you know? Can you imagine being President Obama or someone who has to like make decisions on that level? Like, you have to have an inner sociopath in order to function. And the difficulty, I think, is really keeping yourself grounded in the world of being human and being able to like move back and forth between them, because you want people in positions of authority who can do that without losing themselves to it.
Yeah, it's interesting that point you make that, and I mean, I feel that pain over time. Like the bigger the team that reports to me, the more pressure I have on the like empathetic, but like, let's every, you know, like, why does there have to be any conflict? Why can't we just, you know, and then it's just like, okay, we need to break even. We need to be profitable, otherwise we stop existing. And so, yeah, I feel that pain deeply. It reminds me to one of your points of this mindset you need to build, which is like going from what you say, as you say very correctly, we are social animals that think of things from the one-on-one personal interactions we have, and then zooming out as like, okay, well, what is all the context that is maybe affecting this? There's a term that I always forget, but full disclosure, looked up while you were saying that. I'm like, what is the term for this? And they call it the fundamental attribution error.
FAE.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Which is like, yeah, I wrote about that a couple times.
Excellent.
Like our tendency to assume to our agency crazy, what's actually, yeah, we assume that we have more impact on the world than we do.
Right. And we assume that other people's tendency of like, why are they doing this thing? Well, it's because of the kind of person
yeah.
they
yeah,
are.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
yeah.
Or it's
exactly.
because of their motivations, as opposed to like, oh, well, they have some, you know, oh, they've just started cat sitting today and they have some huge problem. Ah, oh, their apartment is literally on fire right now. It's like, no, it's because like it must be because I wrote my email is too long. And so that must have been why they're slow to respond to it. And I just suck at writing, or maybe they suck at whatever, right? And we create all these stories because that's the way our brains work. We make
the
stories.
Interiority versus the, yeah, exactly.
And so that's, you know, as difficult as it is, that's the skill that we're building. And hopefully coaching is building that mental model of, okay, where does the actual attribution belong? Because we want to build and evolve the systems. Not only do we want to live in these systems, hopefully we're helping improve them if we're managers, and certainly if we're managers of managers. And you had a little kind of quip in one of your posts where you're talking about like a signal that maybe somebody could use some more systems thinking, which like anytime somebody's thinking like, oh man, those other managers, they must be either stupid or hypocritical or bad at their jobs. And it's like, maybe they might be, it's possible, but let's first do some analysis. Like, what are some other things that could potentially describe this? And you can just sit there and think of that, or you can also ask questions. You can inquire.
One of the most frustrating things about management is that there are some times when you can't give people the explanations that you know would let they would understand
so
immediately. They would get it.
I hate it so much.
They would instantly, they would understand. They'd be like, oh yeah, totally. But you can't, you cannot, for security reasons, for interpersonal reasons, for privacy reasons. You cannot. The only thing you can do is hope that you have built up enough trust with your team that when you say, because I said so, that they give you the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. And then hopefully you don't have to cash in on that very often. That's one of the things I've never run a public company, and I don't know if I ever want to. I'm pretty sure I don't ever want to. But that's one of the things I dread is like when you get into like, okay, well, like this information is like meaningful information that you disclose on the markets or whatever, like adding additional layers of disclosure and regulation and all that kind of stuff just adds more circumstances where it's just like, yep, we're doing this thing. Why are we doing this? Like one of the things that you talk to people who work at really large companies, you often hear, and people know why it is, even if they don't say why it is because it's so famous, is like stuff that legal has said. Like you talk to people at Amazon and they're like, oh yeah, all of our Slack channels, the history gets purged after like 15 days. And then you're like, that sounds like they weren't willing to pay for the extra storage. It's like, no, they're on the Ultra Enterprise plan. But legal doesn't want any, you know, they don't say, oh, lay legal told us, or I don't know, maybe legal did tell them that's why. But like the assumption is because that there's at the scale of Amazon, of literally a million employees across everyone, including all of the warehouse workers. But like there's going to be someone in some channel being like, oh man, we're really completely monopolized this market, right? Or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
In some private channel.
Yeah, and this is why I feel like it's so valuable for engineers to become managers and then go back, because managers are never really going to have the credibility with engineers that their fellow engineers will. And there are some times when, you know, because we're, like you just said, we're storytelling creatures. When we don't have the information, we make something up. And like, I've seen so many times the engineers will just be like, oh, management, blah, 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 blah. You know, they're out to get stuff. And a senior engineer will just step in and go, guys, it might be this, it could be this, it's probably something like this. And then everybody's like, oh, okay. You know?
Oh, yeah, that does make sense.
That does make sense.
Because
you
get a different story and you're like, I just wanted a story. And the first one that came to mind was that.
Exactly. The world is against us. You know, I got to say, one of the most infuriating, frustrating things for me has been, as an engineer who I still very much identify as an engineer, I'm coming to realize that the most profound and meaningful things sound the most fucking banal. It's just like, you like go through this intense experience and you come out the other side and you're just like, whew. And then it's like, oh yeah, hard work makes you better at your job or something stupid yeah. like that. You're just like, Jesus Christ, did I just say that? Did those words just come out of my mouth?
I went through that much pain to learn that lesson.
I know. You know, it's just like the stupidest shit. And you say it out loud and you're like, oh my God. Or like, company values matter. The mission statement. Like, I spent my entire life just like making fun of those fuckers because they're so generic and so stupid. And I come all the way around to realizing, shit, that actually really matters. It really deeply connects to people's motivation and love for their work and meaning in their jobs and all this shit. It's frustrating.
You know, I'll defend you from yourself a little bit, Charity, that I think that a lot of our and I was the same in the past generation, cynical locality about like the company values is disproportionately lobbed, and I think rightfully so, at the kind of company values that you'd see where, what are the company values? It's like deliver outsized returns for our shareholders, optimize synergy in a vertical markets, right? Like, things that are so
copy-pasted.
Like
copy-pasted.
How did you, yeah, copy-paste is literally any organization could have this.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean anything to distinguish you from any other organization because you've just described a textbook from the 1960s about how a corporation works, right? Whereas like, you mentioned a value today, which is we hire adults. That's a company value that Honeycomb has. And I've never heard that as a value. I'm sure there's probably at least one other company out there, especially now that you publish it and you become a more successful company and maybe other people hear about that. But when I hear that as a company value, that makes me think, huh, it gives me pause a little bit. And then I think, what are the implications of that? That seems like it maybe actually makes some of the trade-offs you've been talking about today. And so that implies to me that these are things you actually at the leadership level are thinking about and engaging with around things like we want to have people that are building trust and not necessarily, this is a, you know, people will joke some companies and startups can become a bit like a daycare where you just have a bunch of people maybe being kind of toxic or not pulling their share or just doing whatever they like that doesn't even help the team. But you know, we're just going to all try to corral these people. And, you know, with every engineering manager only has 4 reports because they're also high maintenance or whatever. But you're saying, no, not that. The opposite of that, maybe not the extreme opposite. Of course, we still want to support people, but we're going to try to make a stamp in this direction. And so I think that the company values where they can be really valuable, but they aren't fundamentally always valuable at all organizations, is when they both really actually play through the whole organization into the way that we hire, the way that we promote, the way that we make decisions, and all of that. But then also that they say something, that they exclude something, they take a bit of a stand, like that actually really distinguishes you in some way from the median organization.
Yeah. I like that.
You can send that note back to your past self. Okay. Be like, well, one day I will be the leader putting these company values and repeating them over and over again. But trust me, they're not going to be these banal cliche ones.
Got to learn everything the hard way.
You could have just, you could have in theory just said that, but in practice, sometimes we need to do it in order to learn.
You know, the one that I'm thinking about a lot right now is just, I read this book called like the Customer Service Handbook or something. And it's great. It's like 150 pages. Mostly stories, and it's talking about stuff like why people love shopping at REI, and like the customer service mission statement from REI is like something about, you know, we support and empower people lifelong, you know, quest to, you know, conserve and enjoy the wilderness or something. And so they hire people who love the outdoors, which is why they're different, like Sports Authority and all this stuff. And all these little ways you see it like trickle throughout the organization. Sounds easier than it is. And like conversely, then you've got like Comcast, who's like, you know, the worst company in the world. You remember that phone call that went viral where this guy was trying, like, first of all, you cannot cancel your Comcast account online. You have to call someone. And as soon as you call, you get transferred to a customer retention specialist who gets paid based on talking you out of canceling your Comcast account. And some guy like recorded like an 8-minute call of them just like refusing and it went viral and everything. And then Comcast like apologizes like, oh, this is not up to our standard. And it's fucking is. You hired somebody to talk him out of canceling his account. You're literally structured. That is not like putting your customer, like trying to make them happy or successful. You're literally incentivizing the opposite. Like that's systems thinking, right? It's just like creative systems.
What is the system that created that?
Yeah, exactly. So what I've been thinking about, like, I feel like we started out this conversation talking about making the implicit explicit, right? And I feel like Honeycomb is a pretty customer oriented company. Like people love hopping on, you know, if something's wrong, you have to get to an engineer. Our engineers are like, fuck yeah, we'll do this, you know? But I feel like there's, it's uneven and we don't really have, something I realized is like, we don't have a company value around that says, refers to our customers at all. And I think that like for the next, over the next year, I really want to like draw that line explicitly that all of this that we do is in service of our customers, which sounds obvious, but it's not necessarily. And if you don't draw those dots explicitly, it leaves room for confusion and other things to creep in. Like the few times, like Honeycomb, like the people here are amazing and culture is by and large great. Well, I would say that, but like there have been a couple of times in the past where I felt like we got a little navel gazy. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, because that was us acting like the company exists for us. And it doesn't. It exists. We do all of this, not because we're the most diverse company out there, not because we believe so much in work-life balance. Like all these things that we do are in service of our customers. And that was kind of a little bit of a mind-blown moment to me.
And it's very easy to get into that mindset where the company is the purpose of the company when you are someone who is spending your day working on the company. And it's your life's work. Your life's work is to build this great culture and a diverse team and strong values and great processes and all these things. And so you want it to be really good in and of itself.
Yeah.
And so you read books about how to make the company better. And some of those books might be about how do you deliver customer value. And those are often good books for reading. But other times, the books are just about culture or about coaching people or about creating emotional safety and all these things that are super valuable tools to create a business that actually can sustain itself and keeps existing and doesn't go bankrupt because you're just navel gazing.
Christine and I met at Parse, which was wonderful product. Mobile backend as a service, really before its time, really that's where I learned the value of design and you know, engineering tools and technical products and like the passion that people had for Parse was incredible. We got acquired by Facebook. Facebook eventually shut it down. I will never forgive them because they're assholes. And other companies actually offered to buy Parse. They're just like, oh, write the paperwork. Fuckers. But Parse was never a business. Like they had to get acquired. I remember all of this makes sense to me in retrospect. I had no idea what was going on at the time, but like they were going out to raise for their Series B and they got acquired instead. And at that point we had hired one marketing person and like one or two salespeople. Like they built this beautiful, elegant product, but they were not thinking at all about how to monetize it and make it a sustainable business. And so Christine and I from the very beginning were like, we are building something that people will pay us money for. Like we are not doing any of this, like bullshit. We are building a sustainable because, you know, we want our destiny to be in our own hands. And the key to being at the helm of your own ship is business success. If you're doing well, or even if you're doing okay, investors don't want to fuck with you. They don't want to mess with what's working. No matter, even if it's kind of wacky, they're just like, well, it's working. We don't want to touch it. It's when you wobble, it's when you're not doing well, that they're going to step in and they're going to suggest things to some value of suggesting.
Yeah, well, if you're raising money and if you're losing money and need to raise your next round, it's not, a suggestion.
Exactly.
It's like, exactly. Hey, here's how you can not die. And that suggestion is probably not going to have anything to do with all those great company culture value things that you've all been investing your life's work in. It's going to have something to do with some spreadsheet that may or may not be feasible.
May not be in line with what we have thought we wanted for the product or anything. Like it becomes taken out of your hands. And so, yeah, business success is the currency that buys you the freedom to experiment with your culture.
That's a great segue into the last thing I wanted to try and ask about today, and because it ties into navel gazing and it drives into the culture you want to build, which is something that you said, which I'd never seen it said before, but they found it really thought provoking, which is you encourage people to choose boring culture. Which is kind of the opposite of everything we just said. I was just saying, oh, pick interesting values that don't, you know, distinguish yourself from other teams. But you likened it to this, you know, now famous, kind of, I guess, seminal idea in our field, which is like choose boring technology, which isn't obviously not to mean that intentionally bad technology or intentionally bad culture, but the idea of that if every single aspect of your tech stack is novel or every aspect of your culture is novel and someone comes into the organization and all everyone is doing is maintaining these weird things you've chosen, you may be spending your time and effort in the wrong place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Innovation tokens, you only get a couple of them because they all take a lot of resources.
Yes. And I felt that pain fairly acutely over the years. A couple times I've done things at Steamclock where I felt, here's a thing that isn't working as well as it could be, and surveyed what other people were doing in retrospect without very much time and effort, but just kind of like doing a quick check and a bit of Google when reading the first 10 results and maybe one book and be like, everyone else sucks at this. We're going to make our own system for X. And often what I would be trying to do is take something that would make sense for a much larger company that was way more complicated than we needed at our size, but then try to get the benefits of that scale at our smaller size when really we just needed a little more discipline or to just talk to more companies our size and just just do the normal thing. And then I spend a ridiculous amount of time and attention doing that. So I very much feel like that was kind of like a little bit light bulb went on when I saw that idea. My question for you on that is, so you talked about how, yeah, you want to have some unique parts of your culture and you want to invest in those, but that the novel parts of your culture are not nearly as important as the health of your culture. And so my question for you is, how do you describe, like, what is a healthy organizational culture look like to you? Obviously, we agree that culture is important, even if some of the aspects of it are quote-unquote boring and that we haven't necessarily created a totally novel PTO structure or something. But what does health look like to you when you're thinking about that?
Well, I think it looks like, to the extent possible, that everyone feels like they have agency in their job, that they care about it, that they feel personally invested in it, and that their creativity is like engaged in it, because most companies fail. And most of the time, most people are kind of checked out at work, but they have the potential to do so much better if they actually care. And in order to care, they have to, you know, not be just like taking orders, right? They have to like be engaged in it in some way. And if they actually care about their work, then the next step is kind of to have healthy sort of feedback channels up and down the hierarchy, because if you need to course correct, you need to be getting that information. You need people not to be scared. You need them to care enough to speak up. You need to be able to sort of like get the information you need to make good strategic decisions. I'm holding up this book, The Advantage by Patrick Lencioni. I literally have a copy of this on my desk at home and here on my desk at work, because it's the subtext title is Why Organizational Health Trumps Everything Else in Business. And I cannot recommend it enough. It's by the guy who wrote The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. And we've like book clubbed it with it. Christine and I book clubbed it a couple of years at Honeycomb. And then we book clubbed it more recently with the entire exec staff. And there's just like, this guy is, I think of him as kind of like the James Madison of like organization. Like James Madison was like this constitutional genius, you know, and this guy has like spent his entire career just understanding organizations. And he's got some stuff in here that is, you know, pretty, it's like build a cohesive leadership team, you know, figure out your strategy, communicate your strategy, communicate it again, reinforce it, you know, here's how to run good meetings and stuff, which really like, you know, to be successful in business, you need to be building something that people want. You need to be able to, you know, receive feedback from them. You need to be able to change course, make directional shifts and, you know, in response to the market or to changes or whatever. You need to have emotional safety. Your team needs to lean into conflict, you know, lean into disagreements. One of the things that I think that lead is a sign of a healthy org is alignment at the top. I think most exec teams don't spend enough time just making sure that they all have a similar view of the world and that they all think the same things are important and that they're communicating that consistently to their teams. It's this boring stuff that sounds so table stakes and so just like I said, banal, right? But I think that a lot of companies just don't spend enough time on these basics. They get so distracted with all these other things, but like so many of the pathologies of most companies arise from, you know, when execs have not resolved conflicts between them, they aren't aware of them, or they haven't resolved them. They have to get resolved somewhere. So they get resolved or they just like linger.
Multiplied out the entire org.
To the entire organization. If the execs don't deal with it, the entire organization has to deal with it. And that's what gets so stressful and frustrating. You have this vision of what needs to be done and your counterpart and the other party has an entirely different vision of what needs to be done. And you're just like at loggerheads and it's frustrating, you know? And so like, there's the bottoms-up view, which I think is really around making sure people are curious, engaged, surrounded by other people who are curious, engaged, empowered to make changes, you know, learning that they're all growing. You know, nobody wants to just be static. And, you know, everyone should be growing and, you know, pushing their boundaries. And like, you want a culture where it's normal to be curious and have curiosity be rewarded and all these things. And then from the top down, I think you need to have a group of people who can disagree, can argue, you know, who can work it out, who are committed to, you know, synchronizing, who are committed to, you know, making sure there's a clear strategy. It's really hard for most, actually maybe not. It's been really hard for us. I think there are a lot of easier products out there, but it's hard, but it's work that if you're not doing it, it's not going to get done.
To defend you from yourself again, I think strategy is fundamentally hard. And I think it's a common thought that part of why strategy is hard is because by its nature, it's about like a prediction that you can't test, that you can't trivially test. It's not just like the tactics of like, oh, we do this or this, or we'll go on the daily metrics. Like your strategy can't be driven by daily metrics. It needs to be a big cohesive bet on the direction of the world. And that's hard.
Yeah. Even if you have a great strategy, then sometimes a pandemic comes or there are like market corrections and your entire, this happened to us twice last year. We had a great strategy. It was working. And then the world changed. We had to come up with a new one. I don't know if you read Emily Nakashima, our VP of engineering, has wrote two baller articles on becoming a VP of engineering. They're worth their weight in gold. And one of the things that she talks about is just that what is different or what's challenging about being a VP versus being a manager? And one of the things she says is that alignment is so important. Like she realized that, you know, one of the things that she realized was that, you know, as a manager, as an IC, it's, you know, one of the things she did as a VP, it was she continued to like do these heroics. She had this side job basically working nights to get us through SOC 2 compliance. And then she realized at the end of that by doing that herself, she had hurt the org by completely hiding the costs of all this work so that we couldn't budget for them. And it wasn't visible to us. And meanwhile, you know, her directors weren't getting the guidance that they needed. And, you know, I am someone who I work at the extremes and I love just like wearing myself out. And I realized that I can't do that. It is a responsibility of leadership to always have something in the tank because you don't know when you're going to get tapped and you always have to have those reserves, you know?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And obviously there's the other piece of your team learning. Like we've talked so much about the importance of them having learning opportunities and growth and agency. And then if you're just like, I'm just going to take this thing and I'm going to go run with it and shield you all from it. It's like maybe it feels like you're doing the right thing. But then you exhaust yourself. And then when an actual thing, the team needs you for something and you're so tired that you're snapping at them or whatever, it doesn't help anyone.
Yeah, no, the question of like healthy organizations is, I think, you know, and the other thing that I think I wrote in that piece was that people bring the fun. Like the company doesn't have to be fun because you work with me. People bring the fun and the jokes and the humor and the, you know, all that stuff. Like it will be fun if people are working in a healthy place. People bring the chaos and the energy and the fun. You don't have to like entertain them.
Yeah, it's interesting. You said that, and that was another one of those things I saw in that piece where you kind of crystallized something that I have observed, which is that a lot of the things that build a healthy organization, people trust each other, people have communication paths, people have a shared understanding, people feel like they're rallying towards a shared mission. Those set the conditions for people then doing fun things. And then somebody's like, let's have a trivia night. Like, I didn't tell anyone that was like, oh, you know, it's really important that everyone attends a trivia. You need to make it. It's just like some thing that just sort of popped up out of nowhere. And then people do it and they enjoy it. And if they stop enjoying it, then they'll stop bothering to. And you need to give people the space for fun, which is, I think, part of maybe the misunderstanding where people think mandatory fun. Like, that's going to be the way you want a fun organization. But the way to build that to your point is making the space for it and the preconditions for it rather than designing it as a leader from a top down from you want bottom up fun.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Cool. Well, I love it. This has been a lot of fun.
A lot of fun for me too. This was a really great conversation.
Where can people go to learn more about you and your work?
Well, you already quoted my blog, charity.wtf. There's also honeycomb.io. And I think the honeycomb.io blog is one of the best technical blogs out there, just like constantly publishing. And a lot of it is vendor neutral. A lot of it is, we don't do hard sales in general, but there's a lot of just like theory and practical stuff about observability and about, you know, instrumentation and about being a high performing engineering team and about collaboration and a lot of interesting stuff. So I got a plug for that. And I guess that's about it.
Yeah. Well, I'll link both of those as well as that book that you were talking about. Thank you so much for making the time to be on the show.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me.
It Shipped That Way is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. If you're a growing business and your customers need a really nice mobile app, get in touch with Steam Clock. That's it for today. You can give us feedback, follow us on social media, or rate the show by going to itshipped.fm/contact. It helps a lot to hear what episodes people are enjoying and who you might want to hear on a future episode. So let us know. Until next time, keep shipping.